Hello, I'm Ben Folds. Welcome to my Arts Folk 2020 podcast series, where we have an opportunity to hear from presidential candidates on arts policy issues. I've been traveling across the country all year, busy with a summer concert tour, my national book tour, and now fully into my symphonic music tour, but I always jump at the chance to talk art and politics with presidential candidates. And today I have the pleasure of interviewing presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. While the arts is something that isn't often included in the mainstream discussion, we're really grateful to candidates like Marianne for taking out some time in their busy schedule to tell us how she intends to steer this very important national asset into her national vision for education, national service, healthcare, and the economy. So welcome to the show, Marianne.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I admire what you do and what you stand for.
Thank you. First of all, let's establish you and your history with art, because what you do is does cross many lines. You know, it's political, it's social, it's artistic, and you communicate. So when you started, I understand singing was a big part of your career.
Well, what I learned as a singer, I was kind of a singer the way Bill Clinton was a saxophone player. It's something I did. It's something I did, but never anything. I learned very early that I was more talented at the in-between song banter than I was at the singing.
Right.
I would start talking about the great American songwriters, and I would tell stories about George Gershwin and Cole Porter, and I realized that was really where my talent lay, was in all the stuff I was talking about, more than the way I was singing.
Well, but that's interesting, because actually what you're doing, I think, as an artist, because art is about communication, is you're there to communicate in the first place. So to me, I would read that as your impulse was you had something to communicate, and you started by standing on a stage singing as part of that, and then realized you could just cut to the chase by speaking. I'm interested in that because I think that art is not often seen just as purely communication. So if you're talking about educating kids in the arts, the misconception is that you're trying to make them into official artists when it actually impacts everything. I mean, you can certainly see a direct line between your interest in arts as a kid and your business and your what you do now, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it goes deeper than that. I think that these categories are themselves man-made. You know, the arts originally emanated in ancient times from the temples. So when we talk about that which is sacred, that which is artistic, that which is not artistic, life itself is an art form. Life itself is an expression. You know, when I was a child, people had hobbies. You very rarely hear about people just having a hobby anymore. For instance, when I was a kid, I took ballet classes and I played the piano, but they were never at a level where I assumed I would have a profession, I would get paid, I would actually have a career doing those things. But it was understood at that time in our society that the value of things, the worth of things, was not necessarily determined by its utilitarianism, by whether or not it would bring in money. And I think when I was a child, it was far more of a realization. I remember taking art classes at the museum in Houston. I think anybody very early on could see that I wasn't talented at drawing, but nobody thought that that was the only reason that you took an art class. Now, when I talk about two things on my campaign that are related to this, and one of them has to do with children, where I talk about how over and over that I want every school in America to be a palace of learning and culture and the arts, because when we started stripping our school budgets stripping away arts funding. And also in terms of our society, you know, what we give to the National Endowment for the Arts is tiny compared to what other countries of comparable wealth give. And that is for the same reason. What the arts do, what culture does, is expand us as human beings. But a virulent strain of capitalism that has hijacked our country and corrupted our government sees no value in anything that does not produce money for that system. And this is a dangerous path for America. And one of the things that the arts does, too, is it makes us more free-thinking people. Because when you are dedicated to an art, you are receiving and giving information from a level that is not stuck within a certain rationalistic box that has come to define so much of our culture. You know, there's more to life than that, which is just some rationalistic, formulaic approach. There are the muses. There is the intuition. There are the leanings towards that which is beautiful, for no other reason than that it's beautiful. But millions and millions of years of evolution have gone into producing beauty as part of the ecosystem. There's a purpose to it. I mean, why is a flower beautiful? A flower is beautiful to attract the bees. Why is a woman beautiful? To attract a man so the species can propagate. I mean, beauty is part of this all. It is that which attracts us to our higher nature. And the peripheralization of art and culture in the name of this false god of economic achievement is a terrible, terrible path that America's on. And turning away from that path is one of the most important things that we can promote.
Well said. Three questions come to mind here that I'm interested in chasing down. One is, you would say that when you were a kid, you had more access to art because it was more understood that the value of it was just in being a human being. It was an important part of becoming a person. And now you would say that it's less.
Well, just look at school funding. I mean, when I was a kid, I grew up in going to public school, and we had music classes, we had art classes, we had drama classes. When you look at the funding of American education today, it's extraordinary how much of that has been stripped away. It's amazing how many of the schools you'll see, you know, the art teacher come in once a week, or the music teacher come in once a week, how much of that has been stripped from the funding of our public education system.
What do you identify, and you mentioned capitalism, but what do you identify as being that which started to change things from the time that you and I were kids and now? What is the culprit there?
It's not capitalism itself. Now, some people would argue that it is. I do not believe that. I do not believe that the problem is inherent in capitalism. It is, however, and it has been since the 1980s, it is a virulent strain of capitalism. It is a capitalism that is unfettered. It is untethered to any moral or ethical consideration for people or for planet. It has no concern about anything other than the short-term profit maximization for stockholders. And as you and I know, that which is beautiful, when you create a piece of beauty, that may or may not bring forth immediate economic benefit. It just uplifts humanity, right? And so and that's what I meant by that economic false god that we've all, and so then what happened there was that very pernicious, soulless economic worldview, because of the money that corporations can wield as undue influence in Washington, corrupted our government, and in time began to hijack our value system. Now look at the college loan debt itself. So we have a $1.5 trillion college loan debt. When you look at how many young people particularly, and even people who are not so young, but when you look at how many young people are facing tens and even hundreds of thousands of dollars in college loan debt, think how many of them would say to themselves, I'd love to be a writer, I'd love to be a painter, I'd love to be an actor, I'd love to be an artist, but if I take that career path, how will I ever pay off these college loans? And that's why in other countries where the arts are valued as they should be, more money is invested not only in the arts, but in anything that gives people the opportunity to find what their own dreams are and to follow the path of their own dreams. Because I think everybody, you know, one of the things about artists and actors and so many people in the arts today, there's a little preciousness of people thinking that they're artists and other people aren't. I think all creative life, all well-lived life is a creative expression of some kind.
No, I'm with you there. I'm more interested personally in the earlier years of exposing people to art, because it's just part of being a human being to understand ideas and creativity. and enjoy those things.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why I mentioned the public funding in our public schools. How and that starts, like you're saying, that starts in elementary school. I remember my father would never let us use coloring books. He had a problem. He said, my kids will not be taught to color within the lines. He always had a problem with somebody else telling us where the lines were and that we were to color within that. And he'd go on these philosophical rants about how dangerous that was. He said, nobody's going to tell you where you want to paint purple, you paint purple.
Well, another parenting success story.
That's right.
It doesn't look like he raised someone who paints within the lines.
I will not draw within the lines. I won't.
That's
do it.
Funny. Well, do you think we get sucked in? Like, you know, look, I'm an artist, I suppose. I'm a musician who makes music. I'm out here swinging to try to make sure that our arts are funded, and I'm learning the language of the kind of person who argues for the business benefits of art as a way to help persuade those who will listen to invest. Do you think that there's a wormhole that people like me could get sucked into, and do you have any advice as to how to frame? I have one of my least favorite questions I'm asked when I'm in your position and being interviewed is, give me your elevator pitch on the arts, because I don't talk to people in elevators personally, but and I don't like a pitch. But what do you say to that, just in terms of advice for people like myself who are out advocating for something which seems to certain ears to be futile?
Be unabashed in your insistence that not everything is about the money. That's the problem too many people make. We figure that we have to try to justify a higher philosophical stance in lower philosophical terms. Don't do it.
But if I'm asking for money, I'm already talking in terms of money, and I'm recognizing the importance of money.
Well, I do understand that. I do understand that.
And that's a quandary.
Yeah, but wait a minute. When you walk into any major art museum in the world, well, I don't know about the world. We'll talk about the United States, which is really more relevant to this. Look into any major art museum, and you're going to see, or a symphony hall, right? Lincoln Center, any place. And you're going to see on the wall the names of the masters of the universe, the major corporations, and people of major wealth who have contributed $500,000 to this. And why? Because it's a real ego thing. Don't apply to their economic bottom line. Apply to their ego.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you look at the history of, you know, some of the great composers, they had patrons. Well, Beethoven, all of them. They had patrons. You know, it's called a patron of the arts. I mean, it goes back to an ancient tradition. That's what I would do. Is that there is no, and listen, I want to say something. I think that, first of all, I think that people of wealth in the United States, I don't think people want to create wealth, the average person, thinking that it's at the expense of somebody else having the chance to. And I also believe that there are many people of wealth in this country who, having achieved that wealth, would like to believe that it will be used in a way that is helpful for the society. And those, the main people you want to reach in order to get arts funding anyway are the people for whom it really is discretionary spending, for whom they really don't even have to worry about whether or not it makes money, but whether or not it is a legacy, whether or not their name will be associated with something that is uplifting to society. That's not just idealism on my part. That's real. That's true.
What do you say to someone who then says, well, look, you know, the goodness of humanity, if someone has a lot of money, they're going to be patrons of the arts. Why are you trying to get the government to spend money on this?
Because for the same reason, actually, in the sense that it uplifts the state of humanity. If you only have a profit-driven arts world, then it's no different than a profit-driven health system. The money always is invested more in that which is the problem than that which is the answer. I'll give you an example in the arts. So if you say basically people say you don't need government to do that. What they're saying is that the private sector will figure that out. Okay, so then you look at what the private sector produces in terms of the arts, some of which is wonderful, but much of which is what we would call total crap. That is because the taste that one needs to develop for great literature, the taste that people, the appetite that you need to develop in order to appreciate classical music, the appetite that needs to be developed in order to appreciate great painting, this begins in childhood. If all you've ever had is junk food, your taste buds can't even taste the healthy string bean or Brussels sprout. It literally, those taste buds become deadened. So if somebody isn't taught as a child, I mean, that's why when you see little children being led through programs at art museums and somebody is explaining this is a Picasso and this is Matisse and you see a little eight-year-old, it's so exciting because these children are learning it at an early age. And so that's why it matters. And also it matters, I mean, they have even done sociological studies, they've done psychological studies. Beauty is a beneficent. You know, we're talking these days about the mental health crisis. We need to do more than to talk about the mental health crisis. We need to talk about the root cause of the mental health crisis. We need to talk about why everybody's so tense, why everybody's so anxious. And when we do that, we start seeing some of the ways in which we have peripheralized some of the most beautiful things in life, the things that matter most, the things that make life most meaningful, the things that make life most connects us to our true nature and connects us to each other. And that's what the art does. That's what great beauty does. It reminds you of the essentials. It takes you to someplace beyond this tired and weary world. And we desperately need that right now.
Well, I think it's refreshing to go back to the human aspect of this like you do, framing it in terms of beauty and why you live. Because, you know, as I say, for me, I've been trying to learn a language, and I still think it's important. I mean, if you have happy people and you have enlightened children and teenagers, they're going to graduate into being the kind of adults who are happier about the success that they do have and understand how to communicate and can therefore make a successful business. So I still feel that talking to someone who understands things in terms of capitalism and business, it is probably effective to tell them that they're going to grow better small business men and women if they have a smattering of arts education and some inspiration as a kid that it all
well,
they have to follow.
You even have some scientific basis for that. I mean,
right.
Having more art in your life increases your intellectual acumen. I mean, that's just true. People who read more and art education as a child, I mean, you can find all kinds of scientific backing for that.
So to go back to money, which is a part of the conversation, the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities and what we spend on that, as you mentioned earlier, it's nothing. It's just a drop in the bucket.
It's an absolute pittance. I would have a lot more.
I think what we usually ask for these days is to double it, and that makes it a dollar per capita. That's a dollar per head, which is really still nothing. It puts it puts the combination up to about $325 million per year when it's about half that now. Do you have a figure that you like to tell people that you would increase funding to the NEA and the humanities?
Yes, I would like three or four times. I think asking for two times the amount is asking for too little. And that's the problem that progressives make. The Americans have been trained to ask for too little. So we should have, whether it comes to universal health care, whether it comes to a safe and healthy environment, whether it comes to economic justice, whether it comes to criminal justice, whether it comes to arts funding, this should not be something that we think is too much to ask for. None of those things. All of those things should be considered the right of every citizen in a society as prosperous as ours. Notice that once you have enough money, it's so interesting on this, isn't it? Once you have enough money in America, it's understood you want a beautiful painting on your wall. Once you have enough money in America, it's understood you want to go to the symphony or to the concert. Once you have enough money in America, it's understood you want to have a beautiful house.
And you want your kids to have an arts education.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, you know, what I love about your approach is it's absolutely brave. You don't have the normal cautious filter about these things. What can you say to people who advocate for the arts to what kind of weights do we have to lift to get that?
Well, you know, I think part of this is age. You know, those of us who are old enough remember a time when it wasn't like this. If you're old enough, you remember a time when money wasn't everything. And so I worry about a younger generation who doesn't even remember a time when America wasn't at war. A younger generation who doesn't even remember a time when our government wasn't so slavishly devoted to corporate profits. And I part of it is just not only remembering that time, but remembering that it was a better time. And also, I think when Americans travel and to other countries, particularly European countries, to other, you know, particularly Western democracies, and realize how much more other countries put into things like this, and you realize, well, why can't we have that? So I think that's part of it. And the other part of it for me, you know, my father told me you can't, you know, don't draw within the lines. I think the Americans have lost, too many of us have lost our rambunctiousness. And that's how they get to you in a system like this. They just wear people down. And at this point, we feel embarrassed and we feel exhausted and we feel we don't have the right sometimes to ask. Even like when you said double the arts funding, you know as well as I do, even doubling it is way too little. So what are we talking about here?
No, it's true. No. I think you're dead right about that. I mean, I'll still go out and do what I'm trying to do and say, could we double it? because that's what I've learned. But yeah, I mean, you can see. I mean, one thing I like to I think a really interesting way to look at how much we spend on the arts is in terms of time. It takes 20 minutes for us to pay for the arts and humanities on our budget on the average every year, meaning in 20 minutes, we spend that $155 million. And then the rest of the year runs out. We spend equally for the entire rest of the year, and we never spend another cent. 20 minutes on the entire year is insanely low. And at that rate, you could almost argue for 20 times as much, and you could do it with a straight face. That's not even a day.
So look at the 2017 $2 trillion tax cut, where 83 cents of every dollar went to the richest individuals and corporations. And you better believe the corporations as well. I mean, look, go into any of these like corporate palaces, banks, hedge funds, you know, the major domo corporate headquarters. You better believe they have corporate art. You better believe they're painting. You go into any of their waiting rooms, and there are these major paintings all over their walls. You go into any of these major law firms these days, there's art everywhere. This is all about a major transfer of wealth and resources into the hands of a very few Americans. And they spend it on art. That's what's really going on here. What's really going on here is our having allowed a kind of corporate elite and aristocracy to take over this country and to dominate the expenditures of the public realm. These are not people who do not value the art.
Right.
These are people who value the arts for themselves.
Right.
This is the major philosophical contest we're talking about.
Yeah, well, and since there's always going to be that class, and there's always going to be massive corporations, and as you mentioned before, they are patrons to different degrees. You certainly, because you involve yourself in charities, would have some opinion or policy about taxes when it comes to charitable donations. Because as I understand it, charitable donations don't get the kind of tax break that might be helpful.
Well, not any. Some of that's right, moving in the wrong direction. And by the way, once again, mine is not an anti-capitalist argument. It's
right.
Not an anti-corporate argument. That's not what we're talking about.
Totally, yeah, I understand that.
We're just talking that in the in the last 40 years, we have made the short-term profits for the stockholders of these corporates. We've made it, like I said, a new false god.
Yes.
So let's look at what happens. So we need to get, see, this is, and this is so true of everything that I've been talking about for the last year on the campaign. We tell the truth, but we need to do more than tell the truth. Then we need to tell the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So this is what really goes down with some of these major corporate entities, right? They have a charitable giving. They have a charitable giving office, right? And so they get a lot of good PR benefit because they go around to charitable organizations and institutions. It could be the arts, it could be a humanitarian project or something like that. And they give $50,000 or they give $100,000. And everybody goes, oh, thank you so much. Because it just sounds like they're being so charitable. Well, the truth of the matter is, this is all under PR for them. Because while they're paying $100,000, maybe $150,000 as a quote-unquote charitable donation, their lobbyists are in Washington making sure they're given tax cuts to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars. And we all buy into this. And everybody goes to these charity dinners and they're being sponsored by this bank or that bank or this financial institution or that financial institution. And everybody goes, oh, thank you so much. When anybody's really looking at what's going on in this country, which may not even be, I mean, it's nice people. They're nice people who work in that charitable giving department. And they're very well-intentioned, nice people working there. But we as the American people need to see what's going on. Of course, they're giving $100,000, $150,000, and they get the good PR. People love them. Meanwhile, the corporate lobbies are making sure they get tens of millions of dollars in corporate subsidies and in tax cuts, which squeeze everyone else out in such ways as taking the arts out of the funding of our public schools.
What do we push for that's maybe not in the for the Democratic Convention's arts platform? Do you have language or some specifics that you would like to see go into that?
Well, do they even have an arts platform?
What I'm going for is there may be an opportunity for, say, an artist corps.
Well, that would be fabulous.
Which would be similar to, you know, it would be part of a public service. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Well, you know, I just love that. I'm going to remember that you said that. That's such a fabulous idea. One of the things that I would do if I were president is to have a non-binding referendum. And the referendum would be only to be voted on by people under the age of 30. And the non-binding referendum is to find out whether that generation would be open to a one-year mandatory national service. And it would be in whatever area that you wish. And I love the idea of an artist corps. I love the idea that you could sign up as an artist and your job would be painting murals all over disadvantaged communities, let's say, and making public spaces beautiful. I love it. I love it. I love it. I will definitely take that. Was that your idea?
We'd been bringing up the idea, it was the American for the Arts, of an artist corps. And it would precisely be what you're talking about. And it's not unprecedented because, of course, this was happening in the Depression with the New Deal. But, you know, with public works, you know, one of the most beautiful interiors of a building you'll ever see, hopefully you've not been there, is the Department of Justice. Absolutely astounding artwork in there. And that was part of public works.
Are you aware, have you ever been to Detroit, Michigan?
Oh, yeah.
In the art museum there and the big mural. What was Frida Kahlo's, I can't believe I'm blanking on his name. He's a very famous artist, Mexican artist, Frida Kahlo's lover.
Man, I wish I knew. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's absolutely, yeah, you do know the name. You would know. Oh, of course. Anyway, it was Henry Ford, actually, who commissioned it. A mural which would celebrate the American worker.
Right.
But when it was Diego Rivera.
Oh, okay.
But when
Go
Diego
ahead.
Rivera did the this was amazing because he was hired by Henry Ford to do this incredible mural that would celebrate the American worker. But then when Henry Ford saw what it was, it's a complete I think he was a communist, or certainly leaning in that direction, and it's a complete condemnation of the exploitation of the American worker. So Ford covered it over. Unfortunately, we still have it, and now it's there at the lobby of the Detroit Museum. It's a magnificent piece of art.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's time for that too. And you gave us a lot. I was going to just add to this artist course thing. Just personally, I don't know if you really sort of followed it, but something I noticed around maybe the early 2000s was an increased, really huge interest in universities for a cappella music, for singing together.
Oh, wow.
And what struck me about that was it almost appeared to be inversely proportional as music education seemed to be less and less emphasized. You're getting kids going from doing fraternities and sororities, leaping over to actually singing together. And the universities have really not paid for this. They haven't really, they might give them a room to sing in, but it's not really sanctioned by the colleges. But each college has between 4 and 10 seriously good a cappella groups. What I find with those kids when I talk to them is they're ready to work. And I think as for an artist corps, it would be interesting to reach out to that network of kids who are out there singing together because that's their instinct to work, sing, do anything for towards the arts. And I'm just going to put that in your ear because something I've noticed, it's interesting when you take something away that's basically human like that from children, it looks like they just take it back for themselves.
That is amazing. Well, I think that's how nature is. And that's the good news and the bad news. When we are completely out of balance, in time, I mean, we have free will, but when we are completely operating in a way that is out of balance with nature, and when you're talking about the arts connect us to our own nature. So whether it's the physical earth or it's the spiritual realms, and art is in the spiritual realm, if you behave in a way that is counter to nature for long enough, nature will reassert itself. Now, when it comes to the arts, what you're saying is that people just have this internal knowing of what they crave. But on other levels, there are far more dangerous consequences that will result from our being so out of sync. And sometimes people are not as aware of what it is that they crave, such as a deeper connection to nature. And you know, there is a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous that every problem comes bearing its own solution. And I think that the yearning that people have, including among people just like yourself, this sense that it's your mission in life to help promote this, is something coming from deep, deep within the collective psyche of the human being, that we need to re-embrace the arts in order to put ourselves in the position to be the people that we need to be in order to put our entire society back on track.
Well stated, an awesome way to end. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I so appreciate you having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Hope to see you out there and give them hell in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, thank you. I hope that your listeners will go to my website at marianne2020.com and take a look.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe today to the Arts Vote 2020 podcast series with Ben Folds on Anchor, or any of your favorite podcast apps. Please go to artsactionfund.org/podcast for more info. That's artsactionfund.org/podcast. You'll get more info.